Let's go back, if we can, to about 11 p.m. on a Thursday evening in the year A.D. 31. And there's a full Passover moon just beginning to lift its lower limb above the Mount of Olives. And it washes that whole valley and the hill of Zion in a shadowy silver light. And somewhere in the city, the Lord and 11 disciples find their way down from a rather spacious upper room, down the stairway and into that crooked and very narrow maze called the streets of Jerusalem. There are any one of a number of gates they can get out to go out the east wall of the city and find their way across the little ravine of the Kidron River, the brook Kidron. And there, just a few hundred yards east of the wall of Jerusalem, there is a garden. And its location and its use are such a well-kept secret that for 3.5 years, the leaders of Israel have been unable to locate that as the place where Christ goes for his private devotion and many times for his evening rest. And they would not find it tonight if it were not for the presence of a traitor. And so along toward midnight, the Lord is there in the Garden of Gethsemane, and he of all those 12 men present first sees what is coming, because you see, from Gethsemane, it is a clear view westward, just a few hundred yards to the city walls. And if you are facing westward, if you are facing the temple, any one of those three gates through which the Roman soldiers, the Praetorian Guard, the temple police, and a mob of Pharisees might come would be instantly recognizable. And I have a strong feeling tonight that Jesus saw them from the moment that flicker of torchlight and lantern light and that babble of voices first became obvious coming through one of those gates readily recognizable from the garden, because I think Jesus was facing west. Now let me tell you why I think so. Turn, if you will, to 1 Kings chapter 8. 1 Kings chapter 8, a familiar story, lots and lots of times repeated, although perhaps never repeated enough. Folk, we don't get into this book enough. It's time to go back and start being Seventh-day Adventists, isn't it? 1 Kings chapter 8, beginning with verse 22, "And Solomon stood before the altar of the Lord in the presence of all the congregation of Israel, and spread forth his hands toward heaven. And he said, Lord God of Israel, there is no God like thee in heaven above or earth beneath, who keepest covenant and mercy with thy servants who what? Who walk before thee with all their heart." Never forget the standard of the gospel and the standard by which people walk before God. Verse 29, "That thine eyes may be opened toward this house night and day, even toward the place of which thou hast said, my name shall be there. That thou mayest hearken unto the prayer which thy servant shall make toward this place. And hearken thou to the supplication of thy servant and of thy people Israel when they shall pray," where? "Toward this place." Now go forward in time a little bit, and you see repeated in the time of Daniel this Jewish tradition of 1,000 years that when God's people are in trouble, when there's something to pray about, you are on your knees and you are facing the temple, whether it's across the Kidron Valley or 600 miles distant over the western horizon. Daniel, we go down to the 6th chapter. The familiar story of a man whose life is now on the line for the simple issue of prayer. Religious liberty is nothing new. It's as old as time. It was a problem back in the time of Darius the Mede. We find Daniel in verse 10, "Now when he knew the writing was signed, he went into his house, and his windows being open in his chamber toward" where? "Toward Jerusalem." Jews, sons of Israel, when they had something to intercede before God about, prayed toward the temple. And I submit to you this evening, Jesus was on his knees facing west. And that temple lay just across the valley, great monolith of marble, a house soon to become desolate, a place where at this moment the priests and rulers were plotting the murder of the Son of God, and Jesus prays. And folk, when he prays, he is in agony. He's not praying in the relaxed pose that we oftentimes see of the familiar picture of Gethsemane, robes beautifully laid out in artistic array. He is clawing at the air. This is life or death. In the New English Bible, he says to his disciple, "My heart is breaking with grief." And facing westward, facing the temple, he is the first one to see that gate open and see that flicker of lantern and torchlight coming out across the little ravine toward him. And of course, that wall of the city is a perfect sounding board, and the babble of excited voices projects right into Gethsemane. And Jesus gets up and he goes out to meet the enemy. Notice how it reads here in John, the 18th chapter, beginning with the first verse. When Jesus had spoken these words, he went forth with his disciples over the brook Kidron, where there was a garden into which he entered, and his disciples. And Judas also, which betrayed him, knew the place, for Jesus oft-times resorted thither with his disciples. And Judas then, having received a band of men and officers from the chief priests and Pharisees, cometh thither with lanterns and torches and weapons. And Jesus, therefore, knowing all things that should come upon him, went forth and said unto them, Whom seek ye? Now, I think it's in Ephesians, is it not, that we are told what the armor is that the Christian wears? All sorts of accoutrements to that thing. The breastplate of righteousness, feet shod with a gospel of peace, truth about your loins, the helmet of salvation, the shield of faith. But notice something interesting, there's no armor on the back. And Christians never turn their back to the enemy, they always go to meet the enemy the way David did when he had to face that great threat from Goliath. So Jesus goes forth to meet the enemy, and he says, Whom seek ye? There is, as we well know, a brief and very furious and very one-sided fight in which one man has an earectomy. There is a miracle performed, and then the disciples scatter to the wind. They're so anxious to be rid of Jesus and to be out of there that one of them, a young man, flees stark naked out into the darkness. And Jesus is then, as we see in verse 13, led away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. Jesus is now bound. He is in the custody of a praetorian cohort and the temple police. And he begins to encounter a legal system which he himself designed and which for 1,000 years has seemed to exist for the single purpose of saving life and showing mercy. Right into the most awesome legal system that I have ever encountered. Now, when I was in law school, I had the privilege of studying comparative law. I studied with a European professor at a Catholic school who was very much into comparative civil law, the law of the Mother Church, Thomistic rationalization, if you will. Another course that I had was English constitutional law taught by Brigadier Miller, Brigadier General of the Royal Signals, British Army, who had, by the way, served in Palestine with Lawrence of Arabia. I began to get a comparative picture of what human law is like, but brothers and sisters, I have never in my life encountered anything like Hebrew criminal law. It is the most astonishing, mercy-oriented law that I think has ever come down in the history of the world. It was so protective of the criminal defendant that it's a wonder to me that anybody ever got convicted of anything. Jesus walks straight into this legal system that, in my opinion, is designed to show what God is like. And the first thing he encounters is a system where there is no such thing as a professional prosecutor. Doesn't exist. There's no word for it in the language. There is no district attorney, no U.S. attorney, no prosecuting attorney. If you, as an Israelite, wish to bring a criminal charge against another person of the nation, you, as the witness, will have to serve as prosecutor. That job becomes yours. And it's an awful lot easier to say it than it is to do it, for the simple reason that you will appear before the great Sanhedrin, all 71 of the top Jewish lawyers in the nation, and their function is to act not only as judge, but as criminal defense attorney for the accused. Now, folk, I don't know whether you get the significance of what I'm saying, but there are no lawyers in this world better than Jewish lawyers. I've practiced with them, I've practiced against them, and I want to tell you something. If you're ever sued, take a look in the upper right or upper left-hand corner of the pleadings and look at the name of the attorney representing your opponent. If the name ends in Stein or Berg, you've got a problem. There are none better. And here is a witness trying to prefer criminal charges against somebody in a capital case, and he has to appear before 71 of the brightest Jewish lawyers in the world, and their function is to defend as well as judge. If you choose to become a witness in a Jewish criminal proceeding of that day, you will, before you enter the Hall of Hewn Stones, the Lishkat HaGazit, the place in the temple where the defendant is tried, you will be given a stern warning, among which is the reminder that if you perjure yourself and you are convicted of lying to the court, the penalty you sought to impose against your brother Israelite will be turned right around on you. Turn, if you want to, back to Deuteronomy 19, verse 18. Deuteronomy 19, 18. You remember the statement about an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, this business that Jesus referred to and said, you've heard this, but there's a better way to go? Well, it comes right out of Jewish criminal proceedings, and it's the penalty for perjury. Deuteronomy 19, beginning with 15, because we'll be coming to this point in just a moment. One witness shall not rise up against a man for any iniquity or for any sin. At the mouth of two witnesses or three witnesses shall the matter be established. So there have to be more than one witness, two, preferably three. And then what happens if a false witness comes? Well, you just go right on reading. Verse 16, if a false witness rises up, then both the men between whom the controversy is shall stand before the Lord, before the priests and judges, and the judges shall make diligent inquisition. Now, folk, that is diligent inquisition directed against you as a potentially lying witness by 71 Jewish lawyers. And behold, if the witness be a false witness and hath testified falsely against his brother, then shall ye do unto him as he had thought to do unto his brother. In other words, on the night of Jesus' trial, the proper Jewish penalty for perjury is crucifixion. Bear that in mind. We'll be coming to it in just a few moments. There's one other reason why you might not be too anxious to be a prosecuting witness in a Jewish trial, and that is this. As there were no prosecuting attorneys, neither were there any executioners. They didn't exist. There was no office. There was no paid office of executioner in Israel. The complaining, successful prosecuting witness had to turn around and then become the executioner. There's a reason why when Stephen was drug out through the gate, the stones were cast by the members of the Sanhedrin. They had been the prosecuting witnesses. So, there is an element of proof that is rather awesome, and the witness is not in a particularly comfortable position. There is no defense counsel. The court itself assumes the responsibility of defending the accused. And let me give you a little feel for how seriously the Sanhedrin took the idea that it was their job to provide any possible defense. During the period of deliberation, after the testimony had come in, the 71 members of the great Sanhedrin, the Jewish Supreme Court, would each rise, the most junior member first, and state his position as to whether he thought the defendant was guilty or innocent. The youngest member voted first for the simple reason that they wanted to eliminate any possibility that the younger members might be influenced by what the older members said. And so the most junior member of the court spoke first. It went on up, 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 all the way, ultimately, to the high priest. All 71 had to speak. Now, in the course of a Jewish trial, if it came about that there was a verdict of guilty and the defendant was condemned to death, there was a process in which the court went through agony trying to reverse itself and save a Hebrew life. Now, as the court sat, a great semicircle of 71 seats, in the middle of which, in the center of that semicircle of which was the high priest, behind the court there were three rows of what were called disciples, young, up-and-coming, bright Jewish lawyers who wanted nothing in this world more than to move those few steps forward and sit on that semicircle of pillows upon which the court members themselves sat. Young disciples, bright young Jewish lawyers. And if in the course of a criminal trial where the death penalty was involved, if in the course of that, the entire Sanhedrin could not come up with a theory by which a life could be saved and the defendant could go free, and some young disciple from the back bench of the court could come up with a theory no other Jewish lawyer had thought of, and that resulted in saving the life of the defendant, that individual instantaneously got lifetime membership on the court. Instantaneous elevation from a young, aspiring lawyer to a member of the Supreme Court. All you had to do was advance a theory no one else had thought of in order to save a Jewish life. That's how seriously the Sanhedrin took its job of acquitting the accused. There were some other rules of procedure in the Jewish system, some of which we are familiar. I think perhaps if you were to ask any Adventist what went wrong in the trial of Jesus, The first answer would be he shouldn't have been tried at night. We get this out of the spirit of prophecy. It's something I think most of us know. We learned it clear back in grade school if we went through Adventist education. But the principle is found in the Talmud. If you want to find the source reference for this thing, look up the Jerusalem Talmud, the article Sanhedrin, chapter 1, folio 19, and it says, and I quote, the Sanhedrin sat from the close of the morning sacrifice until the time of the evening sacrifice. There was no other legal time for the Sanhedrin to sit in a capital case. Why? Because the Sanhedrin is the Jewish spiritual leadership of the country, and you don't begin a capital case without an act of worship, which is the morning sacrifice. Anything beyond that is outside the jurisdiction of the court. Any lawyer will tell you that a court without jurisdiction cannot render judgment. So the reason why it was illegal to try at night is simply that the Jerusalem Talmud said so. It was part of Jewish procedural law. Many, many other points we'll just skip over. But I want to tell you that there were so many checks and balances designed to protect the accused that, as I said before, it's a wonder anybody ever got convicted of anything. The system was so protective of the criminal defendant that if execution actually occurred, if the individual were finally found guilty and the execution occurred, the first act after the death of the accused was for the relatives of that person, the relative of the executed person, to pay a call on the judges who had condemned that person to death, a courtesy call in which they said, we recognize you could not have been more fair. You are God-fearing sons of Israel, and you did nothing more than your duty. That's how seriously the Sanhedrin was supposed to take its job. Now let's go back to the Gospel of John, shall we? John 18, 24. Now Annas had sent him bound unto Caiaphas the high priest. And we have the sad story of Simon Peter outside of Caiaphas's palace. And we skip over, if you want to, and refer over to Matthew 26, I think it's about verse 57 or 8, and we pick up the story of Jesus' trial, and it reads, and they that had laid hold on Jesus led him away to Caiaphas, the high priest, where the scribes and elders were assembled. Now get the picture. When the Jewish Supreme Court sat, it was a really awesome spectacle. The members entered in solemn procession. They came in with measured step. They walked slowly and solemnly. Here they are dressed in their turbans, in their flowing gowns. The high priest came in. Gorgeous blue turban inwrought with gold. Across his forehead, that golden plate that said, Holiness to the Lord. On his chest, the breastplate of righteousness, if you will. Beneath that, this gorgeous blue gown. Gathered about the waist with a girdle of purple and scarlet and gold embroidery set off with billowing white linen sleeves. And around the bottom, of course, around the bottom of his robe were pomegranates and gold and scarlet and crimson. He took his seat in the center of this semicircle. The rest of the court sat on these big pillows in arcs extending outward from the high priest. And by the way, what does Daniel 7 say? I beheld and thrones were what? Cast down. The same Hebrew word in Daniel 7 used to describe thrones says merely pillows, cushions. Daniel 7 pulls the symbolism right out of Jewish law and puts it into the heavenly courts. And so they sat on these pillows in a great semicircle, and in front of the court were not one but three court reporters, three scribes. Now here in America we are accustomed to resting the fate of the accused upon the accuracy at the stenotype machine of one court reporter. Thank the Lord they do a pretty good job. Once in a while they miss it, but the Jewish system said no, human life is too precious for that. We would never take a chance of one individual missing the count. And so there were three scribes. Interestingly enough, they sat opposite the high priest where they could get a clear view of what was going on in the court. The scribe at the right hand of the high priest recorded the votes for acquittal, for redemption of the accused. The scribe on the left recorded the votes for condemnation. The one in the middle added them both up and checked each one. Now what did Jesus say? When the Son of Man shall come in his glory and all the holy angels with him, then shall he gather some on his right hand and some on his left. What's Jesus saying? He's pulling it right out of Jewish law. On the right is a vote for acquittal. And when Jesus, the Son of God, rises to the right hand of God, what does it mean? He's voting for acquittal for you, and there's a certainty of your salvation. So there they sit. The Sanhedrin, the cream of the cream, the best that Israel has to offer. 71 of the brightest and best in Israel. Turn back, if you will, to Numbers 11. You'll get a little view of what's involved. What's involved in being a member of the Jewish High Court. Numbers 11. And we'll pick it up right here in verse 16. And the Lord said unto Moses, gather unto me 70 men of the elders of Israel, whom thou knowest to be elders of the people and officers over them, and bring them unto the tabernacle of the congregation, that they may stand there with thee. And I will come down and talk with thee there, and I will take of the, what? Of the Spirit which is upon thee, and will put it upon them. That word Spirit, folks, is the same word precisely found in Genesis 1, and the Spirit of God moved upon the waters, Ruach. That wind out of the primal force of creation, the Spirit of God in Moses, put upon the members of the Sanhedrin at the direct designation of God Himself. The primal force of creation was to be in these elders of Israel. Tradition has it that the original 70 were, of course, under the guidance of Moses, so he became the 71st member of the Sanhedrin. And thus it became a Jewish tradition that, in fact, the Sanhedrin would be composed of 71 members. They had to be of Jewish parentage. There could be no mixed multitude, not at that level of Jewish government. They had to be learned in law, not only current law, but obsolete law. Every law that had ever affected the nation had to be in the brains of those 71 lawyers who are going now to sit in judgment on Jesus. Now, let me tell you, folks, something. That is a little easier said than done. When I was going through law school about 2 years before the flood, we were in the process of converting from what was called the Uniform Sales Act to a new system of commercial law called the Uniform Commercial Code. It's now generally accepted. It's now into history quite some way. But let me tell you something. There is nothing more thankless than sitting in law school and learning two systems of law, many of them antagonistic, which apply to the same subject matter. Nothing more confusing than that. Now, I've gone back and I'm taking some postdoctoral work in tax law, and I chose it again. Guess when I chose to take this particular course? During the advent of H.R. 3838. And I learned old income tax, I learned the House version, the Senate version, the Conference Committee version, and the version the President signed. Now, to know current law and obsolete law and conflicting law is no picnic. I'm still not clear on the tax implications. These Jewish lawyers had to know it all and know it right. They had to be experienced as sitting judges. They had to have served their time hearing cases and knowing what was going on. They had to be scientists. Scientists in their own right, acquainted with the workings of the human body. Rabbi Ismael was renowned for dissections, showing the origins and insertions of muscles. Others performed sophisticated chemical tests to help determine truth in criminal proceedings. They also had to be linguists. There were no translators in the Sanhedrin. In any trial, at least two members of the court had to understand testimony given in any language then known on earth. They had to personally understand, and the court translated for itself. Now, folk, that is the caliber of human being in front of whom stands the Son of God. Cream of the cream. John 18, verses 13 and 14. Let's go back and say it again. And they led him away to Annas first, for he was father-in-law to Caiaphas, which was the high priest that same year. Now Caiaphas was he which gave counsel to the Jews that it was expedient for one man to die for the people. In other words, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court has already made up his mind. This is no trial. This is a farce. In his very fine book, Criminal Jurisprudence of the Ancient Hebrews, Mendelssohn gives us this quote, "Nor must there be on the bench an enemy of the accused." It was a principle of Jewish law, as it is a principle of our law, that if you have anything against the accused, you disqualify yourself from sitting in judgment on that person. John is the one who tells us, rather pointedly, in John 18, that Caiaphas was the one who had urged the Sanhedrin to sacrifice Jesus for the sake of the survival of the Jewish nation. John would have known that. He was personally known to the high priest. He knew the family well enough he could get Peter in the courtyard the same night of Jesus' trial. And so there we have a court in which the high priest, the leader, the conductor of the trial, so to speak, has already made up his own mind. This same Sanhedrin, which has these rules I've just given you that are supposed to guarantee the innocence of the accused if there's any defect at all in trial procedure, this same Sanhedrin has, within the last 6 months, three times sat in solemn deliberation plotting how they can cost the life of the Son of God. There was in Jewish tradition and general Jewish attitude in those days, a saying that the robe of the unjustly elected judge should be accorded no more respect than the blanket of an ass. Now I submit to you, the Son of God stands before this semicircular tribunal with its three scribes sitting there solemnly going through a charade of justice. In front of a court where the conviction is already determined upon, and now all that is needed is to draw the witnesses in and hopefully make it quick and clean and get the job done. And if that's the case, as Jesus stands there just in an anteroom, just off the main judgment hall, something interesting is going on. And as we turn to Mark 14, I'm going to tell you what it was. That's the next place we're going to want to be looking in the Bible. The witnesses in a capital case were sequestered. They were held outside the main courtroom. And before they went in to give testimony, they were submitted to a rather stern warning as to their duties in the case. And among the questions and propositions put to them were the following. Is it not probable that your belief in the prisoner's guilt is derived from hearsay or circumstantial evidence? Have you been influenced by the opinions of those whom you trust? Are you aware you will be submitted to the most searching examination? Are you aware of the penalty for false testimony? That's death, folks. Perjury back in those days was a serious crime. The witness was reminded that a high moral duty was involved in his testimony, and then before the witness gave his testimony in the court, he received this warning, and I quote, "Forget not, O witness, that in this trial for life, if thou sinnest, the blood of the accused and the blood of his seed to the end of time shall be imputed unto thee. If any witness shall destroy one soul out of Israel, he is held by Scripture to be as if he had destroyed the entire world." There was the warning, the injunction the witnesses carried as they went in to testify. Now I can see Caiaphas, resplendent in those robes which will soon be in tatters. As he says to the bailiff of the court, "Bring in the first witness," and there's a whole group of them waiting out there to come in and say their piece. The witness comes in, and in Jewish trial there was a solemn procedure which was always followed. It was seven foundational questions called the hakiroth. Seven questions before you got to say your piece, you had to answer these. And so the first witness comes in, stands there, confronts the Son of God, who's standing in the very center of the court, all eyes on him, then as now. And the witness hears these following seven questions. "The event about which you are to testify, I asked you the following. Was it during a year of Jubilee? Was it in an ordinary year? In what month? At what hour? In what place? Do you identify this person?" And one after one, the witnesses come through and answer those questions. And to the final one, they say, "Yes, I identify him. I saw him. I heard what was said. I am prepared to testify against him." Now turn, if you will, to Mark 14, 55. "And the chief priests and all the council sought for witnesses against Jesus to put him to death, and found how many? None. For many bear false witness against him, but their witness agreed not together." Now, why was that? You might say, well, couldn't one hear what the one before him said and repeat the story? And could this group of Jewish lawyers not at least get their act together enough to have two witnesses say the same thing? You know why? Because Jewish procedural law required that all witnesses be excluded from the courtroom. The only witness testifying would be the only witness in the room. When he was excused, he was to leave the court, and the next witness would come in having not heard what the first one said. And you see, this thing is taking the form of a trial. Their father, trying to follow their procedure, they're trying to make it look like it's legitimate, and so they sequester the witnesses, and one by one they come in, and they fumble the ball from 50 feet in the air, and their witness agrees not together. Now, Caiaphas is getting in trouble. At this point, the trial is crumbling in his hands like so much sand. You can almost hear the young disciples on the back bench of the third row snickering up their robes. The big guy is in trouble. He is mismanaging a trial, and nothing's coming of it. And the ultimate nightmare is about to happen. This defendant's going to walk out of here, and it's res judicata. It's all over, folks. There's no way you bring him back. And so some other witnesses came in. There arose a certain and bare false witness against him, saying, "We heard him say, I will destroy this temple that is made with hands, and within 3 days I will build another made without hands." Now, Mark, to my knowledge, is the only one of the gospel writers who makes it clear that even those witnesses, not two of them, could be made to agree, because in verse 59 he says, "But neither so did their witness agree." They couldn't even get something as simple as that out in a form sufficient to satisfy Jewish law. Now, why is that? Why is that? Jewish law had an interesting way of resolving disputes between witnesses. You know what they did? At the first instance when a witness disagreed materially on material details of the trial, it was the duty of the high priest to say, "Acquittal, this is a mistrial, the prisoner goes free." Now, why? For the simple reason that the Jews very sensibly said only the mind of God can probe into the mind of a man and determine whether he is telling the truth. And so when there's a conflict in the evidence, the Jewish court didn't try to do what we do. We sit there for day after day hearing all the repetitious and cumulative testimony trying to determine who's really telling the truth. The Jews said, "We don't care who's telling the truth and who isn't. There's a conflict in the evidence, and when that occurs, the witness is excused and the defendant goes free." It's that serious in the Jewish system. No human being, they said, had the ability to tell who's telling the truth. Now, the problem Caiaphas is facing at this time is that he has to have at least two witnesses who saw the whole thing and who say the same thing. And he hasn't been able to do it. Deuteronomy 19 tells us clearly that the mouth of two or three witnesses must the accused be condemned. And the Jewish system did not have what we have in this country. That is a thing called a chain of evidence. Now, in American jurisprudence, witness A could come in and say, "I saw the defendant get in the car." Witness B could say, "I saw the defendant drive the car away." Witness C could say, "I saw the defendant get out of the car 8 blocks away." Bingo, you've got it. Grand theft auto. You've got a chain of evidence. All you have to do is have witnesses whose testimony links one with the next. In the Jewish system, it didn't work that way. There is one of the commentators on the Jewish legal system put it this way. In the crime of kidnapping, which was recognized back in the days of the Hebrews, there were two elements. One is abduction, one is selling. Classic example, of course, is Joseph. Now, suppose one witness says, "I saw the defendant abduct the person who was kidnapped," and another witness says, "I saw the defendant sell the person who was kidnapped." Is there sufficient grounds for a conviction? No, because both witnesses had to see both the abduction and the selling. If you were going to testify, you had to see the whole thing, and your testimony had to agree in every material detail with witness B. And that's the problem that Caiaphas is up against right now. There was no such thing as circumstantial evidence in the Jewish system. None whatever. You either saw it or you didn't, but you never inferred guilt. Now, the classic illustration of that in American law is the attorney who was cross-examining a defendant. Circumstantial evidence. He said, "Now, you have told the court that the defendant over there bit off the plaintiff's ear. Did you see him do that?" "No, sir, I did not." Well, that would have been the time to sit down and rest your case, but the attorney wanted to hammer it home and really make points with the court. So he had to ask the next question, "Then how can you sit here and tell this court that that defendant bit off the plaintiff's ear?" The response came immediately, "Because I saw him spit it out." Circumstantial evidence, you see. Well, it didn't occur in the Jewish system. Didn't occur in the Jewish system. You either saw it or you didn't. And Caiaphas is running right into that reef designed to block the way toward a careless conviction of a son of Israel. Now let's see what he tries to do with it as we turn back here to Mark, the 14th chapter. He is desperate, and he tries something which I tried once as a young lawyer myself. Verse 60 of Mark 14, and the high priest stood up in the midst. Now he's getting excited. He gets up off his pillow. He stands up. He is probably tugging at his robe and pulling at his beard, and his brow is furrowed, and he doesn't quite know where to go next. And finally he says, the only hope I have here is to pry the convicting evidence out of the defendant. You see, he's got several witnesses who had something to say about Jesus destroying the temple, but he doesn't have two that agree. Now, if he can trick the Son of God into saying something that sounds like he's agreeing with one of those witnesses, he's got two, and he's got a conviction. Now, how did Jesus handle that? The most brilliant argument in all the world, absolute dead silence. Jesus stood back, and that high priest fell right on his face with a thud. And the high priest stood up in the midst and asked Jesus, saying, answerest thou nothing? What is it which these witnesses hold against thee? But he held his peace and answered nothing. The most eloquent reply, the one most calculated to stymie this farce of a trial, and Jesus just handled it beautifully. I'll never forget, as a young lawyer, I had a case going on. I couldn't quite get what my people were saying to make a whole lot of sense. I was getting desperate. I wanted to prove that case, and finally I thought to myself, well, there's one chance I have to do it. It's that opposite party up there. It's the defendant up there that we're suing. He's up there in the witness box. I'll see if I can pry something incriminating out of him and prove my case. And I went at it for a while. I just about took his deposition in court. Finally, Judge Deegan, bless his heart, later to become very famous in a major criminal trial in California that hit the press several years ago, leaned over the bench and said, counsel, do you really think you're going to prove your case out of the mouth of your opponent? Well, I didn't think so, but there's no harm in trying. Well, Caiaphas tried, and Jesus held his peace and answered nothing. Now then, there is one thing left for Caiaphas to do. He now does something which is absolutely contrary to Jewish law. He changes the theory of the trial in midstream. The theory of the indictment was that Jesus had operated seditiously, that he had threatened the Jewish nation with some kind of seditious act directed toward the temple. Now Caiaphas changes the theory and he invokes a new novel theory of prosecution called blasphemy. And I think it reads most clearly if we'll go back here to Matthew chapter 26 or 7. We'll find it real quickly here, because he says something that Jesus cannot ignore. Verse 63 of Matthew 26, but Jesus held his peace, and the high priest answered and said unto him, I adjure thee by whom? The living God. Now, when you say that to the Son of God, you've got his attention, and you're going to compel a response. There's no ducking this one. I adjure thee by the living God that thou tell us whether thou be the Christ, the Son of God. And the next thing we hear is an answer from Jesus. And then the sound of elegant fabric ripping. Jesus said, verse 62 of Mark 14, he gives the ultimate statement, the ultimate two words in anybody's kind of language, I am. I am the self-existent one. All the rest of us derive our life from him. John 1 in the New English Bible says, all that came to be was alive with his life. Folk, none of us have life inherent in us. The angels don't, we don't, created beings don't. We derive our life. The life you now enjoy in this comfortable pew is a derived life from the Son of God. You're living part of his life. It's all you've got. I am the eternal self-existent one, answers with his own name. And ye shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power. Right hand of power, once again, Jesus is now the scribe for the defense. He is your certainty of salvation. You shall see the Son of Man sitting on the right hand of power and coming in the clouds of heaven. Great promise of the Christian faith. And verse 63 puts it all together. Then the high priest rent his clothes and saith, what need we any further witnesses? Ye have heard the blasphemy. What think ye? And they all condemned him to be guilty of death. Two major procedural defects in what Caiaphas just did. Three, actually. Number one, the high priest could never, ever, ever become the prosecutor. It was absolutely foreign to his office. His only office was to listen to the prosecutors and do his dead-level best to save the life of a son of Israel. Number two, he changed the theory of the trial in midstream. And number three, he said, "What need have we of further witnesses?" Jesus is now going to go to his death based on only one bit of evidence, and that is uncorroborated confession. Now, is there anything wrong with that? Can a criminal confess and be found guilty in the American system? You bet. It can happen. But in the Jewish system, Rabbi Wise, in his marvelous book, The Martyrdom of Jesus, says the says that the use of an uncorroborated confession is absolutely antithetical to Jewish law. Well, Maimonides in Sanhedrin, section 4.2, puts it this way: we have it as a fundamental principle of our jurisprudence that no one can bring an accusation against himself. Confession is not to be used against him unless properly attended by two other witnesses. So the confession of Jesus was no basis for a conviction. Once again, it was the duty of this court at that point to say there is no evidence upon which to base a conviction. The prisoner will go free. And instead, Mark 14:63, we hear the sound of tearing of that marvelous garment described in Leviticus 21:10. The high priest shall not rend his garment. Something else went wrong here. Something fascinating. I'm going to see if anybody can pick it up. Verse 64, "Ye have heard the blasphemy, what think ye? And they all condemned him to death." Now, given that Nicodemus and probably Joseph were not called to this meeting, that means that probably at least 69 Jewish lawyers on the high court, after hearing Jesus' supposed confession, said, "We believe him to be guilty of death." Anybody have an idea what might be wrong under Jewish law with that verdict? It is the strangest principle of law I have ever seen in my life. Absolutely, totally different from what we live with today. In the Jewish system, if a criminal were unanimously and immediately convicted, he was automatically acquitted. The theory was that no 71 people anywhere ever agree on anything. You can't get 71 people to agree on anything. So the theory was, in Jewish law, if all 71 of the Sanhedrin, or 69, or whoever happens to be there, immediately and unanimously agree that the individual is guilty, that shows a mob spirit. The prisoner has no, and I'm using the Jewish word, has no friend at the court. Does that sound like the Son of God? Does that sound like God's system of justice, a friend at court? In the Jewish system, no single rabbi, no one of the Pharisees, nobody on that court in the Sanhedrin, was allowed to stand and speak against the accused until someone had stood up and spoken in his favor. That's how careful they were about justice. So the very manner of their vote, they all condemned him, tells us at that time, once again, Jesus had the right to walk out of there a free man and never be troubled once again. There was grounds for immediate acquittal. Well, didn't work that way, did it? Mark 15:1. Let's turn the page now, shall we? "And straightway in the morning, the chief priests held a consultation with the elders and scribes and the whole council." Now, wait a second, folks. Didn't we just finish the trial? Mark 14 tells us about the trial of Jesus, tells all the things that happened, up to and including Caiaphas' blasphemous act. And now here it says, "Straightway in the morning they held a consultation." Read the other Gospels, read the Synoptic Gospels, and you will discover that there was a second hearing at sunrise. Now why? Anybody have an idea? Well, someone says the first one was illegal, it was held at night. That's true. You're partially right, but there's a deeper principle in Jewish law still. Under Jewish law, under Mishnaic tradition and Mishnaic compulsion, you could never sentence a prisoner to be executed on the same day when the evidence was taken. The theory behind that was, give us a little time to think it over. Let's have a review. Same thing in California. You never have a capital offense without automatic review by the Supreme Court. And while we had Rose Byrd in there, there were lots of those reviews. Now, under the Jewish tradition, what would happen then would be that after the testimony was taken on day one of the trial, the Sanhedrin would adjourn. They would leave the hall of hewn stones with measured step and solemn faces. They would gather little knots out on the street, little groups of people would gather out on the street. The elders of the Sanhedrin would be in the inner circle. They would be talking, discussing the theory of the case. Is there any way we can save this man? We've convicted him, but is there a theory anyone can come up with that would give us a chance to go back tomorrow and reverse conviction? Around these little inner circles of the senior judges would be the disciples, gathering around their favorite mentors. They would, with respectful mannerism, look over the shoulder and listen as the senior judges of Israel talk about possibility of maybe finding a new theory for acquittal. It was a day of fasting and prayer. The Sanhedrin went home. They did not eat. They prayed all night. The next day they didn't eat. It was a time when a son of Israel was going to be condemned to death, and it wasn't a time to be eating. Never sentenced on the day of conviction. And on the next day, they came back for a judicial review. A writ of appeal, so to speak. Interesting procedural rules in connection with that. You could never, never reverse your earlier vote for acquittal, but you could reverse your vote for conviction, thus giving the prisoner a second chance. And again, they could hear witnesses. Now, with that in mind, let's turn to Matthew 27. I think it's about verse 3 here, Matthew 27:3. And we'll pick up the interesting and tragic story of Judas. You'll notice here Matthew 27 says, "And when morning was come," once again notice, this is the second hearing of his Jewish phase of the trial, "when the morning was come, all the chief priests and elders of the people took counsel against Jesus to put him to death." Second phase of the trial. And verse 3 says, "When Judas, which had betrayed him, when he saw that he was condemned, repented himself, brought again the 30 pieces of silver, said, I have sinned in that I have betrayed innocent blood." Now, Judas is the brightest of the 12. He knows more about Jewish law and business, I'm sure, than the rest of the 11 put together. They're a pack of fishermen who don't much know anything except how to clean fish and swear. And Judas is the bright one, and he recognizes, I've got a chance to save the Son of God. They've got to go back for a rehearing, and at that point, they have to hear witnesses. I know Jewish law. This is the way it'll be, and I will come in, I will intervene, I will confess, and they will not be able to condemn him. That's what Judas is going for. That's why he comes in at this point. Judas, which had betrayed him, said, I have sinned and that I have betrayed innocent blood. And the reply of the elite jurists of the Jewish nation is, what is that to us? See thou to that. This is the day they're supposed to be fasting and prayer, mourning, because they're about to put a son of Israel to death. They come and they have hard evidence. The whole thing's a farce. It's now public, clear public knowledge, and the response is, what is that to us? Now, you imagine a criminal case going on over here in Baltimore where the life of the defendant is involved. The justices are about to close the trial. Someone comes in and says, Justice so-and-so, I saw what happened. He's not guilty. I'm the one who set him up. Can you imagine a justice saying, don't bother me with that. That's irrelevant to this proceeding. Exactly what happened there in the case of Judas. So now we have... Now we have the Son of God on his way to Pontius Pilate. Bear in mind that this same Sanhedrin, which is in a rush to judgment, is the same one which would have granted life membership on the court to any young Jewish lawyer who could have thought up a theory to save the life of the accused. The procedure for a Jewish death march was without parallel in the history of the world. Nothing like it that I have ever seen in any legal system. As the culprit was led to his doom, a man with a flag was stationed at the entrance to the Hall of Hewn Stones, the Lishkat Hagazeth at the Sanhedrin. He held the flag aloft. A mounted officer followed at a respectful distance behind the execution party. He rode on a horse, but his eyes were turned backwards on the flag bearer. The Sanhedrin continued to sit in solemn deliberation even as the execution march was taking place. And if anybody could come up with a theory to save his life, the flag bearer would drop the flag. The officer would gallop forward and say, come back, come back. Don't take him on to the place of execution. Meanwhile, a herald went along with the execution party and he would say the following words. If any man knows anything favorable to the accused in the name of God, let him come forth and speak, in order that the accused may be led back to the Sanhedrin hall. If anybody in the crowd spoke, the procession halted. They all went back and they heard new evidence. And the accused himself was capable 5 times of halting the procession and saying, I want to go back and have the thing reheard. That's how careful they were supposed to have been. How it should have been. What should there have been? There should have been flags in the air. Voices from the crowd. Galloping messengers and legal procedure followed properly instead of farcically. Instead, as the prophet said, he trod the winepress alone. A tribunal whose own rigid legal procedure left it almost powerless to convict even an aggravated felony if a shred of evidence could be found favorable to the accused, had convicted the Lord of creation by bending every single known rule of Jewish procedural law. Now, what had they overlooked? What's the evidence they should have heard? Number one, that the Messiah would be born in Bethlehem, Micah 5:2. Two, that he would be born of a virgin, Isaiah 8:14. Jeremiah 23:5 would have said he will come from the house of David. Malachi 3 and Isaiah 40 would have said, before he comes, a forerunner like Elijah will announce his coming. Isaiah 35:5 would have talked about the many miracles he would perform. Psalm 41:9 should have spoken, if nothing else did, because it talked about his being betrayed for 30 pieces of silver by a disciple. And finally, Isaiah 53:4 told a suffering Messiah. And his response to all of that travesty of justice was simply what? Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. Now, folk, what does that have to do with you tonight? What does that have to do with Adventism? With the remnant of the remnant? Simply this, folk. Revelation 12, Revelation 14 talks about patient saints. It talks about people in Revelation 13 where if you do not go along, there is ultimately not only economic constraint, but the threat of death itself. It talks about a worldwide collapse of justice and the kind of travesty we just heard about tonight. And it says, here is the patience of the saints. Here are they that have what? Commandments, faith, spirit of prophecy. Here are they that have the faith of Jesus. May I suggest to you that for Earth's last generation, whenever and however that occurs, it will take the faith and character of Jesus in order to see justice that badly trampled and keep your cool. And at the end of time, may I solemnly suggest to you folk, you will need that kind of character. You will need that quantity of the indwelling Spirit of God to be able to look at gross injustice. And with the Son of God, in intercessory prayer, say, Father, forgive them. They're dying, and they don't know it. Shall we pray? Heavenly Father, how often we look at Calvary and how little we understand it. We pray that Thou wilt make us students of the Word. May Thy Holy Spirit envelop this place. May it plead with us this weekend. May it drive truth home. And having done that, may it bring all things to our remembrance. In Jesus' name. Amen.
You have been listening to another special American Cassette Ministries presentation. This is a digital recording for optimum sound quality. International Copyright 2007. All rights reserved. To order a copy of this or other presentations, or for a free catalog, please call toll-free 1-800-233-4450. International calls dial 717-652-7000. You may also order from our secure website at www.americancassette.org. There you will discover the largest selection of genuine Adventist preaching available. American Cassette Ministries is not a one-man band. It's an orchestra of outstanding speakers who are all on the same theological page. You can trust ACM. There is no compromise here. If American Cassette Ministries has been a blessing to you, why not take a moment just now and send us a note or an email with your testimony? We'll share it with the speakers and volunteer workers to encourage them. Your prayers and continued financial support are very important to ensure the continuation of this ministry as we help prepare America and the world to meet Jesus Christ. He's coming soon.